As Paige said, my name is Jason Smith. I'm the Deputy Director of the Measure Evaluation Project at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I'm going to talk today about translating contraception into practice in the era of HIV/AIDS. I don't have any conflicts of interest. All right, our first speaker talked a little bit more about rights, but I thought I would start out with a nod towards social justice and say that the United Nations International Conference on Human Rights, held in Tehran in 1968, declared that parents have a basic human right to determine freely and responsibly the number and spacing of their children. All of the other conferences and conventions on this slide have reinforced the same or a similar notion. We have the technology and we have the knowledge to prevent unintended pregnancies. The methods are safe, they're inexpensive, and they're relatively easy to use. From a social justice point of view, giving women and their families the ability to control their fertility provides them with a meaningful way to control a major component of their lives. We can do it, and we should do it because it's the right thing to do. As part of the public health imperative, family planning can help address many of the pressing global health issues, such as those articulated by the Millennium Development Goals. In truth, family planning contributes to the advancement of all of the Millennium Development Goals, but in the interest of time today, we're going to focus on how it impacts Goal 5, maternal health, and Goal 6, HIV. Taking family planning first, there's an estimated 200 million women worldwide who do not want to become pregnant and who do not use contraception. Furthermore, UNFPA estimates that that the unmet need for contraception will grow by 40% in the next 15 years. This chart shows the level of contraceptive use by the level of development. From a social justice perspective, it's worth noting that the world's poorest countries also have the lowest levels of contraceptive use. Research in the area of international family planning has been ongoing in earnest for almost a half a century. However, in the earlier years of population research, the results of research efforts were often siloed and otherwise poorly disseminated. As a consequence, the scientific evidence was not always used as a basis for policy or for intervention design. In the last decade or so, however, there's been a trend in the area of family planning to use the principles of social and behavioral science to improve the dissemination of research results and to actively facilitate the use of scientific evidence to improve policy and to improve program development. The meetings and mechanisms shown on this slide are only a few selected examples of recent efforts to review the scientific evidence, to improve global agreement about what should be done, and to facilitate the use of evidence-based practice in developing family planning policy and service delivery programs. Now, for this talk, I tried to distill a manageable set of best practices that are ready to be deployed now from the many candidate practices available in the literature, and this is what I came up with. Improving contraceptive security means making sure that adequate supplies of contraceptives are purchased and that supply chains are established to ensure reliable stocks at the service delivery level. Increasing the range of methods has been linked to increasing contraceptive prevalence. In addition, from a social justice point of view, increased method choice is part of increased autonomy for end users. Increasing the emphasis on long-acting methods is related to increasing the range of available methods, but it's also related to improving financial availability through lowering system costs and to reducing harm to individuals that can occur in the case of method failure. Screening women who present at primary care service sites to assess their family planning need is not only a way to improve system efficiency, but it's also a way to provide more holistic care for the women who come into contact with the health system. Providing postpartum and post-abortion family planning is another way to take advantage of contact with the health system, and behaviorally, it's a way to take advantage of a teachable moment to talk to women about their contraceptive plans. Strengthening services in the community is often the only viable way to reach remote and/or medically underserved populations. While not all contraceptives can be safely provided by community health workers, many, like pills, condoms, injectables, the standard DAYS method, and the lactational amenorrhea method, can be. Training and supporting community health workers, including drug shop owners, can help to improve coverage in isolated areas. Okay, so here I'm going to shift over to the topic of HIV for a bit. Family planning and HIV prevention seem like they should have a lot in common, but in practice, there's really been a lot less overlap than one might imagine. Historically, the two fields have been siloed with separate funding streams, government departments, programs, and policies. However, in recent years, there's been a growing call for the integration of family planning and HIV programs. Major donors, such as the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and the Global Fund, have begun to support integration of services, and that's something that will likely spur others to continue this trend. This map gives us a quick look at the HIV epidemic. At the end of 2008, there were an estimated 33 million people worldwide living with HIV, and about 2 million of these were children. More than 90% of the newly infected children are babies that are born to women with HIV who acquire the virus during pregnancy, labor or delivery, or through their mother's breast milk. Over 9/10 of such transmissions occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Drawing in the social justice theme again, it's worth noting that many of the poorest countries and the countries with the lowest levels of met need for contraception are also countries experiencing serious HIV epidemics. Between pregnancy, birth, and breastfeeding, infants born to HIV-positive mothers have a raw 30 to 40% chance of being infected with HIV. Now, prevention programs utilizing antiretroviral drugs have been able to cut that risk to the range of 2 to 5%. However, fewer than half of the HIV-positive women in low- and middle-income countries currently have access to these prevention programs. So preventing unintentional pregnancies from occurring in the first place reduces transmission, especially in low-resource settings and especially where treatment options are scarce. At least hypothetically, integrated services should help more HIV-positive women prevent unintended pregnancies and also help pregnant women discover their HIV status, thereby improving their access to appropriate treatment. Making both services available in one location is more convenient for clients and therefore more likely to be used. Integration plans should consider the type of epidemic as well as the level of available resources. In countries with a generalized epidemic, where a large proportion of the total population is infected, but the vast majority do not know their serostatus, increasing access to family planning for everybody is an important strategy for reducing unintended pregnancies among women with HIV. By contrast, in a concentrated epidemic, resources can be conserved by focusing efforts primarily on individuals in most at-risk groups. Integrating HIV services into family planning service sites can be especially useful in generalized epidemics because it offers a chance to provide HIV services to a larger number of clients. Implications for integration include training family planning workers to perform HIV counseling and testing, offering treatment programs, ensuring a secure supply of necessary commodities like testing kits and antiretrovirals at the family planning sites, and structural improvements like supportive supervision for integrated services, modifying monitoring and evaluation systems to capture integration-related data, and strengthening of referral systems. Possible benefits of offering HIV services to family planning clients include increased opportunities to test sexually active people, increased overall use of HIV treatment, and the ability to reach HIV-positive individuals who would not otherwise consider using family planning services. Integrating family planning services into HIV service delivery sites is a better fit for a concentrated epidemic because it provides a way to target the most at-risk individuals. However, it may also be used as an adjunctive approach in generalized epidemics in order to maximize coverage. Integration can occur by training HIV service providers to counsel and refer clients on family planning methods and, if possible, to actually provide contraceptives. In addition to training, providing family planning also requires ensuring a secure supply of contraceptives in the HIV clinics. Again, other structural improvements like supportive supervision, adaptation of M&E systems, and strengthening of referral systems are likely to be necessary. The benefits of this approach include helping HIV-positive women to prevent unintended pregnancies, opportunities to provide men with family planning information and services, resupply and message reinforcement for repeat clients, and greater client comfort due to less fear of disclosing CERO status. During the last few years, great progress has been made towards articulating the logical case for integration, gathering the collective experience with integrated programs, and synthesizing what we know into knowledge translation products for various audiences. These three products in particular, the AIDS Journal Supplement on Family Planning and HIV, the joint WHO-USAID-FHI document on strategic considerations for strengthening family planning and HIV-AIDS policies, programs, and services, and the joint WHO and Gender Health FHI toolkit for increasing access to contraception for clients with HIV are all high-quality sources containing state-of-the-art information on the topic of integration. Breastfeeding has implications for vertical transmission of vertical HIV transmission, as well as for family planning, and should be included or factored into any integrated program. Breastfeeding protects against early childhood mortality. Unfortunately, it's also a major contributor to HIV transmission, and it causes somewhere between 30 to 60% of all vertical transmission cases. Naively, it might seem logical to assume that HIV-positive mothers should not breastfeed. However, in many developing country settings, other infant feeding methods pose serious risks to the infant as well. Providing antiretroviral treatment for either the breastfeeding mothers or the infants can slash infant HIV infection rates to less than 5%. However, at present, treatment is not universally available despite global scale-up efforts. So, what to do? The most recent WHO guidelines on HIV and infant feeding, based on the best scientific evidence available, were released earlier this year, and they address this exact question. There's no one simple answer, but in a nutshell, the recommendations hinge on two factors: the availability of antiretroviral treatment and the safety of replacement feeding. If replacement feeding is safe and antiretroviral treatment is available, the WHO defers to the national and subnational authorities to decide what recommendations to make to their HIV-positive mothers. If replacement feeding is safe and antiretroviral treatment is not available, then WHO recommends exclusive replacement feeding as the safest method of infant feeding. If conditions are not safe for replacement feeding, however, then the new guidelines recommend that all mothers should exclusively breastfeed for the first 6 months. And I think, as was referred to in the last presentation, exclusivity is key here because mixed feeding increases the risk of HIV transmission. After 6 months, complementary foods can be introduced, with breastfeeding continuing until the end of the year one. Breastfeeding itself is a natural and highly effective method of contraception. In the lactational amenorrhea method, or LAM for short, which consists of exclusive on-demand, around-the-clock breastfeeding for the first 6 months, can be as effective at preventing pregnancy as combined oral contraceptive pills. This method provides ideal benefits for the infant and the mother. However, it's a labor-intensive method that may be especially difficult for women who work outside the home. Many breastfeeding women will choose to supplement the contraceptive effect of breastfeeding with another method. In general, breastfeeding women should avoid estrogen-based methods since they can interfere with milk production. However, progesterone-only and non-hormonal methods are safe to use. Progesterone-only methods can be started 6 weeks after birth and may include the progestogen-only pill, implants such as Implanon and the Sino implant, and the progestin-only injectables such as Depo-Provera. Non-hormonal methods include male and female condoms, spermicidal gels and foams, copper IUDs, the standard DAZE method, or permanent sterilization methods. Family planning by itself is important from a social justice perspective and is part of the public health imperative. We have the methods and we know what to do. Family planning is an important, though sometimes underappreciated, tool in preventing vertical HIV transmission. There's still a lot we don't know about integrated programs, but what we do know has been recently consolidated so that programs can go forward now with the best advice we have to give them. Looking to the future, more work needs to be done to evaluate integration's effectiveness and efficiency compared to separate programs, as well as its feasibility in different settings. Breastfeeding, family planning, and HIV are all intertwined. We know how to deliver family planning to breastfeeding women. The latest guidance from WHO on breastfeeding for HIV-positive women and women with unknown status helps to clarify what to do, adjusting for the local safety of replacement feeding and availability of antiretroviral therapy. And lastly, I just want to make sure that it's clear that the opinions expressed in this presentation are those of the authors alone and do not necessarily reflect the views of the United States government or the World Health Organization. But that said, I would like to thank the USA Agency for International Development and the WHO for their support. Thank you.
Same two? The same two people? Okay, then we're back to the same two people. Mary, go ahead.
Well, I don't have a really good question. But Jason, thank you very much. I think you laid out the situation and the issues extremely clearly, and I'm like a crock. Because the kind of information needs to get out there. People need to understand the difference between where it's a general problem and a specific problem. My only question, of course, has to do with the extraordinarily minor issue that you mentioned, which was the lactation delay method. And I was kind of surprised, especially given the previous talk, that you said this is a labor-intensive method. When we know that actually, if someone's breastfeeding anyway, there's no labor added to it.
Yeah. You know, this is a tough room for this this argument. Well, all right. Lots of women choose to breastfeed, and they like to do it, you know, conscientiously, and they do it around the clock, and it seems like a natural and good thing to do. Lots of women don't, for whatever reasons, you know.
Talk about
yeah, all right.
The fact of the matter is the method just demands you know, regular breastfeeding, and this dichotomy has been created that simply is not necessarily the method. And I'm always curious why people choose to make things to breastfeeding harder than they are.
Well, we'll talk about it, Mary.
So in the follow-up to that, so if you're practicing the WAM method and you're also at work in pumping, does that
change. The method stops when you go back to work, so it's not a conflict.
Okay, so once you go back to work, you have to stop that.
Yeah, it, I mean, it's a little bit limited as a method anyway. It only works for just so long, and you have to do it right. There's certain training aspects to it, you know. And like I say, lots of people can do it. Lots of people can't. You know, I recommend anybody who can do it to do it. It has obvious benefits, but if you can't do it, there's other methods that are available to help you with your family planning needs. You're the moderator.
Just having it as a general thing, that if you go back to work, it's not effective. I think as a natural family planning provider, the woman would know her fertility signs, and there are some women who will continue to use this, even though she's separated from the baby. So we can't generalize too much. But the woman has to be educated.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you could move over from lactation or amenorrhea to standard days method or, you know, but I don't know. I work a lot in developing countries, and yeah, of course, you run across people who are very interested in this, and they follow up on it, and somehow or another they find information. But as often as not, I run into people who just don't know anything about sex or their bodies or how any of this stuff works, and somehow or another, you have to figure out a way for them to not have 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 pregnancies. So, you know, there's ways that are a little bit simpler for people who, for whatever reason, you know, can't get to the information or to the life situations that they need in order to control their fertility.
Unlike the last speaker that had 75% women who are educated, they had a partner and either HIV positive and all that, which is a wonderful milieu in which to work. I work in rural Haiti, 50% non-literacy, nobody's married, nobody tells anybody when they're HIV positive. We have a 80% explicit breastfeeding rate. The biggest obstacle to breastfeeding in rural Haiti were the nurses and doctors, wasn't the peasants. So by giving them pumps, it made it real shishi. American breastfeeding clothes and bras, you know, 80% explicit breastfeeding, 6 months. Weaning at 24 months, and a birth space of 39 months between babies without methods. You can rely on methods because, you know, there's no cold, I mean, there's no chain, you know, my cold chain. There's no chain, there's not pills, even the condoms are used for balloons and all sorts of stuff. So
there's problems with all kinds of methods. And, you know, I think that in general,
again, the providers are the biggest limitation because they bottle fed and the peasants breastfeed. And so by getting the providers to breastfeed, it turned the corner for...
I think that there should be a range of method choices, natural methods among them, and any way that you can enable a woman to, you know, be able to... you know, control her fertility and thereby control her destiny. Well, that's a good thing from my point of view. And if it's breastfeeding, that's great. And if it's not, well, that's okay too. You're the moderator. Why don't you pick among these people? Yeah, okay. Well, in this talk, I covered general family planning, HIV and family planning integration, and breastfeeding. There's only just so much detail you can get into in like 12 minutes. So your point is well taken. I probably should have said that.
Is the gentleman here?
One of the issues is where are men in this whole process?
So I'm going to get my question up and tell you about it here.
Well, no, people have been talking about male involvement in family planning for 30 years, and yeah, I think there's a lot of opinions about it. I think there's probably a few studies on it. I think men actually have more involvement than is explicit, but, you know, if you're talking about vasectomy, uptake is pretty low in most places. If you're talking about condoms, you can probably do better, at least under some circumstances. If you're talking about male attitudes towards contraception, like increasingly being willing to talk to their wives about it or being willing to allow contraception, as it were, and I know that sounds like a funny concept to a 21st century United States audience, but it's not in most of the world. Men are there, and there's probably ways to get them more there. That's a very complicated conversation, actually.
It's really not. By changing it from men's okay. involvement in contraceptives to men's clubs for family health, we found extraordinary engagement of fathers in rural Haiti where they have lots of children, because it's not just about contraception, it's about protecting their wife's health, you know, their children's health, making oral rehydration. It's not just about contraception. So we've had great success in the last 20 years with fathers' clubs for family health.
I've spent a number of sessions here where we have talked about the status of women worldwide, and it's almost at the animal level, where they are subdued, oppressed, brutalized, a lot of domestic violence, on and on and on, but on almost a shocking level, that women are not healthy on this planet. And we have to address those issues, and little things like this that you're talking about may save a few women from brutalization.
Okay. Dr. Huber?
You know, there seems to be a bit of a dichotomy between breastfeeding and family planning, and there shouldn't be. You know, thinking about the concepts that seem to work well for men and women is a healthy timing and spacing of pregnancy. Avoid 2 years before trying to get pregnant again, and breastfeed. And some of those of us worked in Muslim countries where women don't have it so great, like Afghanistan, and men are very supportive of their wives. They understand that it's going to be very good for children and their wives, and it fits with the teachings of the Holy Quran. And as one mullah pointed out to me, the Prophet Muhammad knew this 14 years before science showed us how important that good birth spacing is for child health and mother's health. So I think we need to find ways to synergize what's already there and does work for people, whether it's Haiti or Afghanistan. These aren't impossible things, and they should go together. It's both and, not breastfeeding or contraception.
And one way of thinking about that, really bringing together a lot of what people have said, is to take a reproductive rights and reproductive continuum perspective and look at women's rights across the reproductive continuum, their rights to make informed choices throughout, whether it's preconceptual or interconceptual or around family planning and around breastfeeding, and within the context of trying to provide that information for them to be able to do that and then to live out their decisions. And so we do have a few minutes left if we want to open up the questions to any of our speakers. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
So are there any further questions for any of our speakers that we would like to?
Oh, okay. The issue I was going to bring up is really such an out in left field issue, so I didn't push to it earlier. I was speaking to someone at the conference yesterday at the Costa area, and I mentioned that the WHO had changed the recommendation relating to HIV-infected women breastfeeding, saying that now they should be encouraged to breastfeed for 6 months, but exclusively. And I was commenting that the alternative could never have been safe enough in most places. And she said to me, was the rule changed also for American women? And it got me thinking about this issue that when we say, that in that four box thing that he had on the slide, are alternative feeding methods safe and feasible? And I thought, well, what would you use to characterize safe in the U.S.? And so, you can go through a lot of different thoughts on this, but I ultimately came to, what people are focused on is, will a kid die? So they'll say, if you can transmit HIV by breastfeeding, any amount, you've got a kid who's gonna die. But then, of course, children die from other things, and some of what they die from in the U.S. is not being breastfed. So how would you make the comparison to how safe does it have to be to serve formula here before you would be willing to tell HIV-infected women that they should exclusively breastfeed, or that they should maybe heat express breastfeed, whatever. But okay, now I've got my ear.
I can answer that from discussions with WHO colleagues, unless you want to.
No, it's all yours.
frankly, when the term first came out, I labeled it AFS, because, AFFS, because it really is. It has to be acceptable, feasible, affordable. What do these words mean? And I really pushed when I was at UNICEF for WHO to define them. And the way they defined them was to add a few more words. Then, and under the recent changes, what has been determined is that each region, then, of WHO can further define this as appropriate to the region. And what PAHO has decided to do in its wisdom is say, I guess it's up to the countries. So you lose the strength of the international knowledge as you trickle down to groups that have less and less knowledge about it. The net result has been in Latin America that nearly all the countries now say don't breastfeed, which is not at all what the original intent was. And so whenever you have global policy, global right, global anything, the interpretation of it can actually lose the original argument. This question actually brings back to our whole discussion today about rights and justice, because we need those rights and justice up here. And then how do we get them to be recognized and happen and occur? So I think I might even argue then, if we really want rights to happen, we have to learn how to define our terms properly, and maybe that's the whole disconnect that we have. Because this lack of being specific has led to interpretation that's kind of.
If you had the power to make change, with the knowledge we have today and the resources we have today, would there be any condition under which you would change the policy for HIV-infected women in the U.S. and not have it that they should all be encouraged to form?
I think the math has to be done. I think we have to run the data and see. But I would guess that given with the drugs that we have in place and the availability of the antiretroviruses and virals, et cetera, that there probably is a definition. We could probably define where the cut point is between the risk. But I think our health mentality remains that any risk of HIV outweighs anything. So even though the numbers might show that it's riskier, I just don't think our public health mentality is mature enough yet to handle that.
Do we still allow the mother to decide?
No, we never have. So the United States has it. The standard of practice is set by the CDC, and if somebody doesn't follow that standard of practice, they are liable. Whatever
the
that
mother
means.
The mother is liable.
Yes. Uh-huh. And whatever stands. Carolyn, you know.
Well, I just wanted to mention that, not to forget, that at least in this country, pasteurized breast milk is available. And many HIV infected women choose to use that for their infants. But I've also had mothers who chose to pasteurize their own breast milk.
You have that, yes. How do they find out about that?
I don't know how they find out about it, but it's difficult as a healthcare provider, even working in this area, to have to tell them officially it's not recommended.
That's not recommended to have them.
Not officially.
Carolyn, do you want to talk about the undercurrent of physician communication about this? There are several physicians who quietly have been talking to each other. They have supported women with sisters breastfeeding. They supported them, as Carolyn says, to make sure that if they choose to breastfeed that they're or use human milk, that they're doing it in a safe way as possible. And there is a quiet discussion going on among physicians, but people are concerned about getting sued. The other thing is there is a group that I'll just mention because it's out there, and the name of it I forget, Marianne Thompson's group.
Everybody.
Another Look.
What is it?
Another Look. Whether or not you agree with their scientific argument, they are a group out there that is saying that we have to support women's rights to breastfeed, even if you're HIV.
Well, and we are now at our time, so I'd like to thank all of our speakers.